Welcome to CI, Confronting the Issues, bringing a progressive faith perspective to the issues of today.
And we're live with this edition of CI, Confronting Issues, coming to you live from San Francisco. Today we're not in our usual location, which is the Leland Tea Company in San Francisco. Today we're coming to you from my home, largely because of the weather, and because today the show is a little different. My recent illness has caused, well, it wreaked havoc with my schedule of topics and guests, to be quite honest. And so I thought that today I would take care of some housekeeping business by answering some emails I've gotten with some questions about me to let you learn a little bit more about me than what you learn in the little smidgens you get when I'm talking with our guests during our normal programs. And then in 2 weeks, on St. Patrick's Day, we will be back to the more normal format of the Leland Tea Company with a program about accessibility and our worship spaces, and I'll tell you more about that a little bit later. But one of the first questions that I was emailed by a member of my church congregation and someone who just wanted to know, what have been some of your past major life challenges and accomplishments? With that question, I feel like I'm on a job interview here. Actually, probably my greatest challenge was my stroke about 3 years ago, and right now learning to adjust and adapt to a new set of physical limitations that I never had before. That has not been easy, primarily mentally or psychologically. That has not been easy. I've been pretty active and used to doing certain things, and now I can't do some of those things. And it's a little more difficult to get around and do normal day-to-day stuff. So I think that's probably been the greatest challenge. Accomplishments, that's hard to say. Many years ago, I worked for the federal government in the Army Corps of Engineers. I was a readiness manager, and I worked in disaster response and disaster recovery. And I was one of the architects of the Urban Search and Rescue System, which is the special teams that you see, like in Haiti or down in Chile, who go do heavy rescue of big-scale collapses. They got all this fancy electronic equipment and search dogs and rescue specialists and medical specialists. I was one of the people who helped design that program and create the first task forces in the United States. There were 24, eight of whom were located in California. And the idea actually started in California with the California Office of Emergency Services after the 1985 quake in Mexico City and the collapse of the hospital there. And one of the OES members came back up and was thinking about a new approach to heavy rescue and came up with the ideas of the specialized task forces. And the idea sort of grew from there. And with my work with Corps of Engineers, my job became to create the structural engineer training that was part of that and manage the engineer components of that so that I could have engineers ready for each of the task forces and a slew of backup engineers to do lesser work and work with cities and counties in impacted areas to help evaluate structures and buildings. Those of you in California or other places might be familiar with the term red tagging a building that's unsafe after an earthquake. That's part of what they help with, along with cadres, especially trained building inspectors. And I think I'm really proud of my work during that program. We brought that to line in less than a year, 26 different agencies, 120 people from federal agencies, state agencies, and local agencies got together one weekend in Seattle And in that 2 days, we had the skeleton of the plan and fleshed it out. And a year later, we had it passed through Congress. We had our first budget, and our first teams were equipped, which cost about $250,000, trained and certified and ready to go. And unfortunately, the first deployment was the Oklahoma City bombing, and it was my engineers who would halt work if they structurally found an unsafe time in the collapse to help protect the rescuers and people who were going in the recovery effort for the victims of that. So I got a lot of recognition in that program. I was very, very proud to be part of that. And it's probably my best legacy that I could ever leave. And one of the things that I missed about not working with the government anymore, and that was the last project I worked on before leaving the federal government in 1993 because of the other aspects of my position, which dealt with national security. And when I outed, I lost my clearance and lost my job. And so that was its own challenge, but I got through that okay. And the program has gone on without me, as I knew it would. And I am really most proud of that and being able to do something that really helps people. The other piece of that question that that same person asked was, what are your current major hopes for the future? And that is a little bit more difficult to think through because I have so many. And my perspectives have changed in the last couple of years, confronting both my differing abilities now and some particularly difficult health issues that I had starting a year ago, some that were fairly serious at the time, and they really caused me to shift how I viewed life, what I wanted out of life, my life views, what was important to me, what I wanted to accomplish. But I think my hope for the future is actually kind of politically related too, and that is that I would see a more fair society for my LGBT brothers and sisters, that I would see marriage equality enacted in this nation, that I would see us engaged in a more just and sound foreign policy, one that is a little less interventionist, one that is a little less corporately directed, and one that is really designed to help the nations that we go into and help the people. We are a generous people on the most part. We have so many good things to offer countries in the way of developing and of bringing resources in, that's what I would really like to see. And I would like to see my daughter really, on a personal note, really succeed and just be happy. Whatever she does or chooses to do. I have not seen her in years. Again, that's an impact of my transition and outing. And so I would really hope that she is doing well and is happy. And I think we will look at some of these other questions in no particular order. And those of you who are listening on the Internet can phone in the San Francisco Bay Area. The call-in number is 762-1161, of course, area code 415. And that will get you onto the program. The phone lines are open anytime you want to call. We'll be happy to entertain your questions or comments. And the next line is area code 530-413-4511. And that will connect you to our engineers in Paradise, California. We'll do a great job of bringing the phone on, and so we can take your question and or comment. And another line that goes into Paradise is area code 530-413-4515. So don't be shy. The phone lines are open, and you can call any time you feel so moved or have something that you want to contribute or say and give people a break from listening to me. I'll think I'm behind the pulpit again and probably want to start preaching. It's dangerous giving a preacher a microphone too long. Another listener offered me this question. How has the theology of my previous church I worshiped in affected my theology today? And that has a lot to do with my particular views of Christianity have changed. I've become much more liberal in my age. As many of you may know, if you've listened to me before on this program, that I used to be in an evangelical tradition. I used to be a very conservative preacher and evangelist. I held very conservative religious and political views. Then dealing with my own issues, coming out and transitioning as a transgender person, that caused problems in my old church and actually gave me a 13-year exile from the Christian church. And I came back to the church about 5 years ago to a United Church of Christ church, First Congregational Church in San Francisco, which is my present congregation, where I serve as a lay leader and am in the process of seeking a standing as a commissioned minister within the United Church of Christ through our Northern California and Nevada Conference and our Golden Gate Association. And all of those organizations really don't mean a lot unless you're in the UCC, so I won't bore you with all the ins and outs of a particular denomination, but I don't really think that's really important to you all. The main thing is that my call to ministry that I experienced in my prior church is active. In our Christian tradition, our scriptures tell us that the calls and giftings of God are without repentance. They don't leave just because you change directions. And so I began pursuing ministry. I'm still involved in ministry. And so I decided to seek standing with the United Church of Christ, even though I hold standing in another tradition as well. And there I am ordained and am a reverend. But given my social justice advocacy and other issues that I deal with routinely in my activist times when I'm not on the air or not speaking to groups, that really takes up most of my time, and that really is much more of my heart, and that is part of the commission that I will be fulfilling or seeking with the United Church of Christ. I think that what I found in that, in my own struggle, in my own search, is that God, the divine, however we want to define God or the divine, whatever our tradition or beliefs, specific beliefs are in that area, I believe that God or the divine is much more open and adaptive than we give her credit for. And that our tendency to limit and develop systems of us and them and begin classifying people and pigeonholing them and labeling them is not the way the divine operates, nor especially wants us to operate. And so I've become more open. Things that used to bother me, issues that used to really get me going, I find today just aren't that important anymore. That they're fun, and I will still get involved with them, but they just don't hold the importance, and I don't think they hold the importance with the divine. For instance, I'll give an example. Creation. Now, we all know that humans are here. We have this planet. We have our ecology and our world around us, the entire environment, and all of the animals and plants that deal with it. I believe that we should be stewards of that, but the process by which it came about, that it was one grand speaking moment from this voice from heaven, whether it was a process, as we see in the study of evolution, or however the exact technical process is, it's kind of immaterial to the fact that we are here, we are sentient beings, we appear to have some kind of connection or yearning for the divine and the cosmos, and that with that we have a responsibility to take care of this world, to take care of each other. And so anything that interferes with that responsibility or detracts from it, I think, is not so good. And anything that enhances that is good, regardless of its tradition. I do not believe that any religion or faith has any kind of monopoly on truth. I find truth in a lot of different places, not always the Bible, not always another divine text. But I view these texts as wisdom texts, however sacred they are to whatever faith system a person has. I believe in their sacredness. I believe in honoring them. I believe they have truths to teach us, and that regardless of their age, there are lessons that we can learn and apply even today in the 21st century, but they are a book of wisdom. The Bible, for example, may contain historical items, but it is not a history book. It may talk about creation, but it is not a science textbook. It is a book of wisdom to teach us to live and be better people, and a kind of a handbook or field guide, as I call it, pointing towards the divine. I grew up fishing and hunting, so field guides were what teach you what a footprint of a particular animal looks like, their habits, where they lay down, what it looks like when they're in their watering holes or their salt licks. And the idea is you use that information to have a real encounter with the animal. If you're hunting, you're going to stalk it. If you're hunting it with a camera, you're going to take a picture of it. But the idea is to have your own personal encounter with that particular animal. Well, I believe that the holy texts, whatever tradition they are, including the Bible, is a kind of a pointer to the divine. And it tells us what kinds of actions people have taken to get a different kind of results from the divine, and that we can learn from that in the hopes of finding our own personal encounter and touch with the divine, and that that's really the value of it in its wisdom and practice in that sense. Exclusiveness leads to the kind of sectarianism that we see in the world today, divides the world into us and them. It leads to a rise in fundamentalism, which I don't believe honors God or honors the divine in any real positive way. I think it's designed to honor a certain belief system and to uphold that. And I don't doubt the sincerity of people who are there and that they want to do the right thing. I'm not doubting that at all. I just personally believe that there's a more open and a broader viewpoint than that. So off of the sermonizing about that, and that's kind of one of my basic foundational beliefs through everything that I'll talk about today, and especially my theology as I live and try to struggle through life and figure out answers. I don't have that many more answers than anybody else does. I don't believe that just because you're a minister, you have answers. You just have sensitivity to the pathways to seek answers, and that's where I'm at, is seeking those answers and trying to figure out what to do for myself and how can I help my world be a better place than it was when I entered. And that's kind of the basis of my particular theology, related to that, and a little explanation of what I mean when I talk about certain issues that used to get me going just do not bother me anymore. They're just not, they're fun. They just don't have the importance that they used to have at one point in time. And And I think that we spend too much time on things like that that really pull us away from the core message of, I think, the gospel in Christianity and the pillars of faith in Islam and the directions in Judaism and other faith traditions as well, of taking care of each other, uplifting the helpless, standing for justice, and expressing wisdom, comfort, and love, and compassion where we can, and then in the words of Christian and the Jewish scripture, to seek justice, love mercy, and walk humbly before your God. That is the basis of my theology, and I hope that I get closer and closer to fulfilling that as I progress through my life's journey, even though for me it's getting later in the game than I think. The same person asked me, does the pity you get from the people who see you use the walker affect you in any way? And if so, how does it affect you? I had a stroke 3 years ago. I have some mobility issues. I need a walker to get around. I have learned to get by with, I call it my traveling companion. And it was constantly with me. I walk better than I did 2 years ago, but I still need it for balance and strength. I can take short walks without it, but I'm very easy to tip over with that. And you could tip me very, very easily with that. I look like one of those toddler toy Weeblow things that just wobbles and wobbles as I try to walk without the walker. And I don't know about pity so much anymore and assistance, but I know that our view of people with disabilities in this country is very, we tend to shy away from them. And I noticed that people will shy away from me if they see the walker. If I try to get a taxi cab, I'll flag a cab, and they will pull up and they'll pull away. And that, frankly, irritates me. But the people who walk by on the street will also move to another side of the sidewalk or move away or clear away because they see the walker is sometimes very depressing. My stroke is not contagious. The walker is not contagious. I try to be very careful that I don't run over anybody with it or bump into them with it. But I think our tendency to avoid people with handicaps is very noticeable to me. It's very hurtful to many of us. I think it's not necessarily evil. I think a lot of people avoid us because they don't know how to react, or they think there's some way they should react. There's some kind of formula or some kind of order that they must do to do it correctly rather than just being honest, much like a child would be, and come up in curiosity and ask about, you know, why do you use the cart with wheels or whatever. And I really don't mind those kinds of questions because they're honest and they're not meant to put you down at all. The person's just curious. And that is much better to me than this kind of shunning that I notice as I walk out on the streets, walk around town, go shopping, window shop, whatever I might be doing with the walker out in public. That is probably one of the worst things that I deal with. So I wouldn't really call that pity. I call it a fear of handicap or fear of people being different. And what do you do about the difference if you don't know and you don't want to appear out of it or appear uncaring? And so I think it's just a simple matter of the kind of fear of embarrassment or fear of not knowing or fear of doing the wrong thing that keeps many people from approaching us or keeps them kind of afraid of us. We tend to be afraid of what we don't know, and that is true in almost every facet of life. It's part of the human condition. Is that kind of fear and that fear of change, we don't like it very much. Change frightens us, even though we know deep down that change is one of the most universal concepts in creation, and but it still bothers us. We like things kind of comfortable. We like to have some kind of anchor, kind of thing we can go back to that we know if we do this, this item will always be there. If we go to this place, that person or that thing will always be there. So we're coming up, the clock's catching up with us. Want to give you a break for a minute. So we are coming up to our break time. So we're going to take a 4-minute break. And so we will see you back here in 4 minutes.
BBS Radio.
Welcome to the Church of Total Acceptance. If you're a divorced single parent, press 1 now. Goodbye. Welcome to the Church of Total. If you're gay or lesbian, press 2 now. Goodbye. Welcome to. If you're overweight, have a mullet, or anything polyester, press 3 now. Goodbye.
God doesn't filter people out. Neither do we. The United Church of Christ. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you're welcome here. The United Church of Christ, where God is still speaking.
If you have a bumper sticker on your car, question authority, or otherwise think for yourself, please hang up now and have a nice day.
The United Church of Christ. To find the congregation that's right for you, go to ucc.org.
There are many types of storable foods, but how about a superfood that contains every nutrient that the human body needs for survival? 50% protein, 300 milligrams of potassium per ounce, and calcium and magnesium for your heart and bones, with many more nutrients found in this incredible food source that the government does not want you to have. This product is available in powder, seeds, and oil, and is shipped free to your door in the U.S. This product is illegal to grow in the U.S., but is legal to import. Don't waste time thinking about storing food. Plan ahead and prepare for yourself and your family now, and be in control of your destiny. You can save and invest your money, but in the end, food will be your greatest asset. Remember what the Word of God says in Ezekiel 7:19. Call 908-691-2608 and see what the powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Remember, food will be your greatest asset. Call 908-691-2608. This product does not contain THC. Call 908-691-2608 today.
Hey, this is Andy Dooley, and you're listening to BBSRadio.com.
Hey, what's up, peoples? This is The Worderer, and you can peep my flow at TheWorderer.com. But right now, I'm just tuned in listening to the biggest of the big dogs of internet radio. I'm talking BBS Radio, because you're done, though. If it ain't mainstream, then it's gotta be on BBSRadio.com. Roof.
And we're back live with this edition of CI, Confronting the Issues, coming to you live from San Francisco, California. It is not a sunny San Francisco today. It's rather damp and yucky out today. And we are not coming from my usual location at the Leland Tea Company. We are actually sitting by the desk at my home, my little room, my cave, as I frequently call it. And I'm taking some time since my recent illness with pneumonia has caused nothing but havoc with my plans of guests and topics and wreaking havoc with my schedule, that we would take this show and answer some emails I've gotten, some questions about me and my beliefs and what I'm looking forward to, and answering those. And then in 2 weeks, the program on St. Patrick's Day will be getting us back to our normal format from the Leland Tea Company. We'll be back with guests. And that program should be very interesting. It's about accessibility to our houses of worship and the fact that 20%, one in five Americans, has a disability of some type, and that less than 20% of our houses of worship, regardless of faith tradition or faith community, are accessible to most of those people. So I would say to congregations concerned about growth, you could have significant growth just bringing back some of the disabled people for your believers anyway who can't get into your building. So we're going to have a show about that. My guest, John Alex Lowell, is an activist with that particular topic in faith communities. He will just come off of a major conference at Pacific School of Religion on that same topic. And after my program in my home church, we will be airing a documentary film about that, an ecumenical film called A Place for All. So we're looking forward to that. And so that will bring the program a little more back to what you're accustomed to with it or getting accustomed to. So as I said, I've been answering emails that have come in asking questions of me. And one of the questions I've been asked several times by many people is, how do I kind of balance, or how did I juggle my being transgender with my military service, and how do I balance my beliefs about peace and things with my efforts for the military today? And so I'll try to get into that a little bit. And primarily, when I was first in the military, I, of course, had struggled with gender issues and sexual orientation issues, but I have to say that at that point in my life, I entered the military when I was 18. I turned 18 in basic training. What a place to celebrate your birthday. I think we were running to the rifle range that day. And I actually felt at that point in time that if I just went and did this stuff, did the Army thing, did the best I could, that all of those feelings and confusion would go away and that I'd be able to get over it and it might even get cured. Well, I found out some 30 years later that that was not the case, and I ended up having to transition and coming out while I was a civilian employee of the Army here in San Francisco. That cost me my job. At the time, there were not the protections that there are now for LGBT people in the civilian workplace. And my congratulations to Senator Lieberman and the members of the Senate who introduced the Senate version of the Military Readiness Enhancement Act, which is a bill to lift the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy from the military now, so that our LGBT brothers and sisters can serve openly and without fear or recrimination as they serve our nation. And I think we should honor them with that. And I was so pleased this morning to get that news. I am a member of a Peace and Justice Church. Just because I believe in peace does not mean that I do not support our veterans and I want the best care and treatment for those who we send to carry out our national policies and those who serve us in uniform. I believe that we owe them that. We owe them nothing less. We sent them. We gave them that job to do. They serve. They serve honorably. They serve bravely. And we owe them the best care and the best consideration that we can give them upon their return. And so I work very hard for veterans' issues. I am a member of the Alexander Hamilton Post of the American Legion. I'm very proud of that post. It is the only primarily LGBT post in the entire American Legion. I'm sure many Legionnaires are not happy about that, but we are there. It was a 7-year battle to obtain our charter some years ago, and I'm very proud of our organization. We do a lot. The VA hospital and in our communities here, just as American Legion posts around the country, do a lot for their communities and returning veterans. And so I am committed to that. I lobby Veterans Affairs very heavily. I'm an advocate for them. And I am also worked very hard for the lifting of the present Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, so that our veterans can serve openly. I joke with the young veterans today, at my age, almost at all young now. I joke with them that I serve, they serve under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I served under Don't Even Think About It. But even then, we recognized in times when the mission was critical, we had critical skills, that just wasn't important. And frankly, we knew certain people were gay. They were a little more open than they might need to be. But the regulations were still against them, but we recognized their work. And so we just kind of, we ignored their sexual preference. We ignored the homosexuality. We ignored that. And in some cases, like the first Gulf War, we were ordered not to discharge or take any action against them in a stop-loss order from President Bush the Elder. And so there is no reason why that policy needs to continue. Our allies let lesbian and gay bisexual people serve openly and without fear, and has not hurt their unit cohesion, their effective discipline, or their combat effectiveness. They fight beside us in Iraq and Afghanistan today, and they don't report any particular problems, and neither does the Israeli military, who has the same type of policies. And so I don't believe that that is contrary to my Christian values at all. Jesus had positive contacts with Roman centurions, with the Roman military officers, even though I think he knew that some of those officers might be involved with his crucifixion. Three years later, he still dealt with them positively, and I believe that his love and forgiveness extends to everyone, even those who choose to serve their nation in a military uniform. And so I will continue to work hard for my veterans and work hard for those presently serving, that they can serve openly and with dignity and with integrity that we want from those who represent the United States and serve us overseas and domestically. So, again, I believe there's really no conflict there, and that it is just an extension of my duty as a Christian to take care of people and to care for people. And so I do that with veterans, too. And my sympathy for them might well be because I am a veteran. I served almost all of my adult life in some way or another with the United States Army, both active, reserve, and civilian. I served in all kinds of capacities. And so I do feel a very strong connection to our service people today and our veterans. And I think if we get a chance to go back to our program archives, and look at our Veterans Day program in 2009 and my guests on that program. That was a very good show, and I think a lot of information about issues of taking care of those who have served us and committed themselves to us. For me personally, dealing with my gender and sexuality issues, really it was a time of denial, and I was able to do that most of my time in uniform. And so I didn't have many of the bouts, although I obviously struggled with it. I had to hide it. I could not come out with any of that for fear of losing my military career. But at the same time, I had no idea then that we would see a day when LGBT people were facing the very possibility of serving openly in our armed forces. And again, I'm just so pleased of the Senate who did that. And if you're hearing that little flash in the background, that's other emails coming in, and that's one actually talking about the measure to live, don't ask, don't tell. We're involved in a lot of things related to veterans. I think one of the proudest things that I'm working on is a series of public ecumenical services that we're kind of looking at in November of this year, close to Veterans Day, that will have some liturgies specifically to welcome home our returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, but also what I am calling the belated welcome for veterans of other conflicts, especially Vietnam and the first Gulf War, who may not have gotten that deep welcome home from their faith community, and a kind of an understanding that as they might begin reviving feelings of discomfort, feelings about their service, that their faith community stands with them, and that that the Divine One stands with them and is ready to minister and help them, and that their faith community and those people of faith in our communities are willing to stand with them and by them as they go through these memories and struggle with the feelings and impacts of their military service. And so we'll keep you apprised of more of that as programs go on, as more planning takes place. But it's something that came up in our Veterans Day program, and something that several of my associates and I are working on, and that we're really looking to performing sometime in November. So we're looking forward to that for our veterans. I think another issue that I get asked about is our neighborhood connections. And if you recall, a few programs ago, I had a representative from the Mayor's Office of Workforce and Economic Development in San Francisco. He's also a good friend of mine and a member of the Neighborhood Association that I belong to and presently chair. And I'm a strong believer that people of faith, again, regardless of their tradition, regardless of their specific beliefs, can make an impact in their communities and are called to serve their communities in whatever capacity they may feel empowered or talented or led to do. In my case, the Neighborhood Association, I deal with conditional use issues, zoning issues, all kinds of things about our neighborhood environment. One week we might be dealing with an issue of street prostitution in our particular area. The next week we might be dealing with the number of car share parking spaces in a condo development that's being proposed. And so it's all kinds of variety. There are many hoops that businesses have to jump through here in San Francisco, and part of our job with our association is helping our members jump through those hoops and succeed in dealing with those particular commissions and bodies, especially the Planning Commission and our Board of Supervisors, which for some of you who may not be familiar, that's our term in San Francisco for people who might be a city councilman or county commissioner, because here in San Francisco, we are a consolidated city and county, one of the very few in the entire United States. But we are one of them, consolidated city-county government. Our community is very important to us. My particular home church serves as a base or a meeting space for the community group. That's actually how I got involved with it. We provide that meeting space to them in our fellowship hall, in our new building. We were in our old meeting place. We gave them meeting space there, let them use our worship space in that particular building. And now they use our fellowship hall to meet in once a month. And they're very cognizant and supportive of the church and the church's desire to be a resource in the community, both in the kinds of programs it offers and the kinds of events that it sponsors, like pizza nights and movie nights and things like that, in addition to the traditional worship services, Wednesday scripture studies, and things like that that are pretty traditional for churches and communities of faith. So we're very pleased about that. And I see we've come up to the break time again. It is 20 till, and boy, the time really flies in the second half of the program. But anyway, we are ready to take another 4-minute break, so we'll see you back here in 4 minutes.
Welcome to the Church of Total Acceptance. If you're a divorced single parent, press 1 now. Goodbye. Welcome to the Church of Total. If you're gay or lesbian, press 2 now. Goodbye. Welcome to. If you're overweight, have a mullet, or anything polyester, press 3 now. Goodbye.
God doesn't filter people out, neither do we. The United Church of Christ. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you're welcome here. The United Church of Christ, where God is still speaking.
If you have a bumper sticker on your car, question authority, or otherwise think for yourself, please hang up now and have a nice day.
The United Church of Christ. To find the congregation that's right for you, go to ucc.org.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine having banks and credit that serve the community, solvent and free of Wall Street corruption, that create strong local economy and job growth? Banks that put profits right back into the local business and economy, not into far-off foreign investments or high-risk and exotic finance schemes of the super-rich.
Yes, we can.
Can you imagine eliminating income tax, ensuring economic stability, increasing social programs, and improving the standard of living for all Americans while paying off the federal debt?
Yes, we can.
That's right. It's all possible.
Yes.
Can you join us in working towards a solution utilizing principles suggested by our founding fathers through united action and strategies outlined in articles, blogs, and wiki spaces where you can share and collaborate? Please visit Ellen Brown's website, webofdebt.com, and help us make America's money and future of, by, and for the people once again. Can you do that?
Yes, we can.
Caution, if you are prone to being disturbed by real truth and real solutions, please continue to consult with your qualified Wall Street cheerleader economist on network television. Side effects for not visiting webofdebt.com include drowsiness, loss of job, loss of control of national finance, loss of country, followed by panic attacks and rude awakenings.
Hey, everybody, this is your new friend, Julio, and I'm talking to you because I like to listen to BBSRadio.com. I sneak over the border every day. And I go see my girlfriend. She got a computer. Come on now, sing it, girls.
BBS Radio. BBS Radio.
But I can't hang around, man, because the border guards are coming. So I'll catch you later, unless you catch me later. Bye-bye now. Don't forget to listen to BBSRadio.com.
Hi, this is Marco May. Wherever you are, whoever you are, take care, because you deserve the best.
me when I tell you this is all heart, y'all. Yeah. Hey, what's up, peoples? This is The Worderer, and you can check out my flavor at thewerderer.com. And I just love listening to the biggest internet radio network on the planet. You heard me? The planet. Yeah, BBS Radio. Because if it ain't mainstream, then it's gotta be on BBSRadio.com.
And we're back live again with this edition of CI, Confronting the Issues. We're coming to you live from San Francisco, California. In this particular episode, we are not at the Leland Tea Company, as you can tell, probably not listening to the clatter of dishes and food orders being given in the background. We are coming to you from my home, where today I am my own guest, because my schedule got really devastated by my last illness, my little bout with pneumonia, and trying to reschedule topics and guests, I decided in this program that I would take some of the emails that I've been sent and answer them, which should give you a little bit more idea of who I am, what I believe in, a little bit of my background. And so as we come back from this break, of course, we're winding down to the last minutes of the show. But one of the questions that I was sent is, what is a better form of urban ministry, sympathy or empathy? And that comes from a person who is a member of my church congregation. And just to fill you in on a little background, my church, First Congregational Church of San Francisco, has decided to move from Union Square in a building they've had since 1915, but got too big for them to really take care of, and decided to build a new building in an urban neighborhood, the Lower Polk neighborhood of San Francisco, and which is just a few blocks from where I'm at now. And so part of what they're doing is figuring out how to really minister to their community, an urban community, in the 21st century, a very diverse and multicultural city, and really cope with the challenges that that presents, especially in a neighborhood like Lower Polk, which is, it has an entertainment district. It, the residents, most of them do not work there. We have a great diversity in income and socioeconomic class. So it really poses a lot of challenge in how to figure out what do they want, what do they need, what will really speak to the people of this neighborhood. And when I think about sympathy or empathy, I really go back to compassion. And I really believe as a congregation that we need compassion, especially those members of a congregation or faith community who may not live in the neighborhood where that particular church or gathering place is situated. And that is true of many houses of worship, again, regardless of faith tradition, Christian, Jewish, Islamic. The people who attend frequently do not live in the area where the building is. They live in various neighborhoods. We're a mobile society. We live in suburbs. We commute into cities to work. We live in cities and commute across town to work, and so it's not surprising that we would not live right next door to a house of worship, or we might have lived next door to the house of worship, and then as our economic situation improved, we moved further and further away from the urban area until we're out in a suburb or we're away from there, and now we really don't live near there either, and we can lose touch with what's going on in the neighborhood around our particular church building. So I really believe it takes compassion and a combination of sympathy, some true sympathy, being sympathetic to the plight of the people around, especially lower income or people on limited incomes or those with special needs. Our particular area of the city is close to an area called the Tenderloin, which is one of the poorest areas of the city and one of the areas with a high percentage of people with substance abuse problems homeless people, a lot of street people because of that, and all of the issues that that brings forward into a city or an urban area. And how do we meet those, and trying to figure out what really these legitimate needs and really will be a true help to the people and not just a short-term solution. I think it takes both sympathy and empathy. I think you have to empathize with them. I think you have to sympathize with them. But I really believe the key feeling here is compassion, that you need compassion for them, which to me is an action word. And so I would hope that that would speak to any congregation in any community in this country or anywhere in the world, that to speak with both sympathy and empathy of the people around you and just try to determine their needs and what they need and how you can really plug in and take root and be part of that community. And with that, I'm going to come up to the closing minutes of the program. I hope I haven't bored you all to tears with too much information about me. As I said, in 2 weeks, our next program will be back to our regular format. I especially want to thank my engineer, Seth, who got us through this and even set us up using this different piece of hardware, not the typical stuff that I have set up when I'm at the cafe, using a different microphone, different computers, different sound equipment. He was great getting it set up. I want to thank the people who really make this program possible, both financially and with their support of prayer and encouragement, and that's Ken Tipton, a member of my home church congregation and contributor to this program, John Alex Lowell, who will be a guest in our next program, but also is a member of my home church congregation, and a seminarian seeking ministry status within the United Church of Christ, and also my friends in the Lower Polk Neighbor Association, who helped me with things like setup and things like that. Will Otero, the owner of the Leland Tea Company, who provides me a place to broadcast from. Chris Shulman from the Office of Economic and Workforce Development, also an advisor and liaison to Lower Polk Neighbors and a close friend who helps me most every program set up. But today he just started a new job, so congratulations to him. And he has longer hours than he did, so he's not going to be able to do as much with the program as he does before. And so I just really want to thank them and really encourage you to listen in 2 weeks with John Alex Lowell, my guest, and the topic is accessibility in our houses of worship. And that ramping up is not enough. In other words, just putting in a ramp for a wheelchair or walker does not solve all the accessibility issues within our houses of worship. But you might really start considering your own congregations, your own faith communities, and how accessible, how welcoming are they to people with handicaps, given the statistic that I just learned getting ready for this program, that 1 in 5 Americans has a handicap. And to be honest, I expect that to grow as we age. We're going to be an aging society. My baby boomer generation is going to really turn the idea of retirement upside down. But there's going to be a lot of us. We're aging. I know I'm aging far faster than I want to or care to admit to most. And so it's going to make decisions necessary about accessibility and limitations and how we serve our communities. So I really want to encourage you for that. On April 14th, my guest will be Dr. Kolb, a plastic surgeon from Atlanta, Georgia, who is very well known for her work in dealing with the negative impacts of silicone-filled breast implants. She is the editor of a book about returning the feminine to the divine and femininity in leadership. with many, many notable women contributors, including Michelle Obama and Oprah Winfrey. But she will be a guest on the program talking about her book. And so with that, I just want to say we will see you in 2 weeks.
You have been listening to CI, Confronting the Issues. For comments or questions on this or any CI program, contact us via the web at www.myciradio.com. I'm your host, Risha Ann Young. Join us for the next edition of CI right here on the BBS Radio Network, Channel 2.